in a country like Canada, where it's so multicultural, we have to expand our understanding of what cultural relevance actually means for the actual population that we're supporting, right? So I do agree that spirituality is very evident in a lot of, people of color's community, particularly because I'm from the Caribbean. I know that that is something that, and I can't even speak for the whole Caribbean because it's so nuanced, but as a Jamaican, I know that, spirituality is important as a part of your healing modality. And for someone from a Jamaican background who has been in, in conflict with the law, it would make sense to incorporate a spiritual healing modality into their treatment plan because for them, culturally, that is relevant.
What your response just made me think of is that it's like if you follow this idea of cultural specificity sort of to its natural conclusion or evolution, it's like then you have to actually look at what is cultural specific justice or restoration. And I mean that I feel like that is the sort of gateway to abolition, because if we're going to say, okay, it's not just about what meals do you get? It's not just about hair and skincare. It's not just about, XYZ language. Then you have to really get into for communities to have that kind of sovereignty over their own justice practices or their own ways of dealing with harm, and processing trauma. And I'm thinking about, we know you are an expert of how do Black women and Black gender oppressed folks come into conflict with the law. So often it is the result of, these systemic things. And I'm thinking of, also migration, for example, not having the access to literally the resources to job opportunities, all that kind of thing. And the whole pathology around, kind of being an outsider in a way.
Yeah, so this is important, and I've thought about this for a very long time. I'm going to use one example. I was invited to do a present, to be on a panelist. Actually, my manager, current CRF manager Lucy, actually opened the door and for me to do a to do a inter to be a panelist on a global TV presentation, The Color of Justice, in 2018. The actual presentation went well, but it was around, people of color, mainly Black people who experienced incarceration. They had like a series. They did like Indigenous. They did like, but this segment that I was on was particularly around like, Black Canadians who have experienced incarceration and what that looks like, the road that led to that, right? And so that went well. And when I went on, when they posted the clip, and I went on the, and I when I was reading and I saw a few comments saying that, these immigrants come here and all they do is make trouble. And I'm thinking, like, in such a global world, do we really have the privilege to say, to create strong boundaries upon who is an other and who is and who are supposed to be included and who shouldn't be based on where you were born? Like this, I know that for a fact. So in Jamaica, in 1979, around then Prime Minister Michael Manley implemented something that's called the Bauxite Levy. And the Bauxite Levy was put in place so that countries that was removing natural resources out of Jamaica would need to pay money for that. And when I did the research, that's because countries like Canada was extracting bauxite out of Jamaica for $1 a year, any amount that they wanted for $1 a year. This is not me making this up. This is real information. So let's think about the currency and the financial impact that any amount, unsurmounted amount of bauxite that was extracted out of Jamaica for $1, what are the financial impacts for Canada as a country? I'm bringing this up to say that in this global world, in this global economy, do we really have the luxury to other someone based on where they were born? I'm wearing this shirt right now. I can tell you that it was probably made in Indonesia or somewhere, because I cannot afford something that was made in Italy, or, you know what I mean? Like, it was made out of exploitation. So when we think about othering, and when we think about how that actually looks, we have to have a more, you know, I was watching Michael Jackson's feed of like Man in the Mirror, a cappella comes up, and I'm like, that's the kind of approach that we actually really do need to take, like a man in the mirror kind of understanding, like look within first before we start, like, you know, throwing the stone. And I feel like for us to actually move away from, like, get to abolition and get to a restorative justice framework, it cannot be a blueprint, a cookie cutter approach, because we've seen that that doesn't happen. And even when we're having conversations around cultural relevance, it cannot be from a Western lens. We have to recognize that we have to get to ground zero in each subgroup and find out what that actually means, what cultural relevance means for that person or that group. Because cultural relevance, even in one specific subset group, will be completely different because the group is not a monolith, right?
Yeah.
So when we're talking about cultural relevance, and when restorative plans are being made, and when, like, CSCs, you know, when we're doing these activist work, we have to really understand that our lens will not provide the ultimate, like, approach. We have to work with people on the ground in order to find out what it is that they want.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's so right on, because otherwise it becomes this kind of almost like the betterment of the system, improving corrections. And, you know, obviously there is that balance to support folks to be able to survive that system. But at the same time, I think, you know, I mean, to me, I think that's also an energy thing as well. It's like energetically divesting from those systems means to really elevate the significance of the stories and experiences of people in communities that are actually experiencing harm. I think that that is one of the stories that is not elevated enough, is the way that, you know, all of these different schemes, like the domestic worker schemes, you know, the seasonal worker, agricultural workers, thinking about how that separates families. I don't think that it works to keep the lens of a border there, because in fact, people are living these transnational lives. So to then try to ascribe responsibility to someone in one part of the world, like, it literally makes no sense. But, you know, these details, of course, it's very convenient to omit them, because then, yeah, you can just blame this one person for a completely, I think, not even systemic failure, because it's not a failure. It's working exactly as it is intended to.
Yeah. And I think that by a gaze or a glance, it could seem as if we're talking, because we're supposed to be meeting for, you know, to have a conversation around how we came to the Black History Month event. At a glance, it would seem like we've moved away from that completely and we're talking about something else. But I feel like it is connected. And this is also one reason why we haven't made enough of a progress as we should make in terms of social justice and advocacy, is because we've compartmentalized these barriers or events or phenomenon without recognizing the intersectional and the multi-section and how they're connected and woven together, and that we can't actually make change without looking at the bigger picture and bringing all these pieces together. So we've touched on, like, you know, restoration and, like, spirituality and, like, you know, border, and all of those pieces are completely related to Black history, particularly in the Black history, because you know, when we're talking about migration, forced or willing, that's kind of the reason why we're here having this conversation, right? Borders, we're borders respected, we're borders, what kind of security was there for borders, or even like the main idea of a border, like on the continent of Africa, like, you know, borders weren't a thing until colonization, and that actually created a lot of like disruption in spirituality connection and like cultural connection, and the communities created new communities by putting up borders where there were none before, right? So I think that it makes sense. And when we're looking at these things, we have to look at them from a systemic framework and from a principle, in opposed to how they actually look on the ground sometimes, because then we'll see that the pattern are consistent and they're just, you know, the pattern works and it's just being implanted somewhere else, yes. Implanted in another situation, implanted somewhere else, right? Yes. And so these are all conversations that it has impacted not just the Black people, but everyone who has been on the other end of the colonization, where it hasn't been beneficial. And now in Canada, where we celebrate multiculturalism, it's even more poignant that we have this conversation, because we have multiculturalism and it's acting as a mask. While it is a benefit, and while I am grateful for it because I'm here, it is almost acting as a protection shield. So we can't talk about the act like racism, and we can't talk about, you know, like some of the real issues or the real barriers that others, that people who are othered experience, because Canada is a multicultural place. You're here, you're benefiting, but, you know, it's multiple. Sometimes I feel like in terms of multiculturalism, it's like brushing your teeth, but not brushing your tongue, right? Mm-hmm. So the front is clean, but there's like a lot of things, barriers and discrepancies that's underneath, that we need to also address. And if we don't address these things, we will have cavity and then a denture.
Yeah, exactly. Then full removal. Yeah, that's such a, it's such a, but such an on point metaphor, because like it's so true, this sort of cosmetic appearance, and then, you know, exactly, you don't brush your tongue, if you don't floss your teeth, like that is where the rot is happening. So, and I just think it's so, like, not to get too graphic, but it's, you know, like when you're putting the floss there, you have to really, you know, do that work to get out.
You have to go to the crevices. Really look in the crevices, right? So this also brings me to a liminal space. And I've been using the concept of spaces of liminality as a safety shield for me, right? Okay. I don't know if you know about it.
Liminal space, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a geography, it's mostly used in like geography, where like you have two buildings, and in that little space, in that little alley, you know, it might be just like a 1-inch kind of alley or 2-inch or whatever, but it's just that one little space where nothing is.
Yeah.
That is a liminal space in the terms of geography. In terms of like social or cultural or like social activism, Homi Bhabha wrote about liminal space in the context of like social justice. In that context, it's like all these isms and labels and all that stuff, it keeps you, the label that comes with it is heavy and you know, arresting. But in these liminal spaces where there's no label, these small crevices is like where growth can happen. And for me, those small spaces where I'm not a Black woman, I'm not an immigrant, I'm not, you know, a dark-skinned Black woman, or I'm not like 5'10", a giant, you know what I mean? I'm not all of these things. I'm not like a UFT graduate. I'm not a wife. I'm, you know, these things, these is where the liminal space is. And that I feel is connected to spirituality. And absolutely, that is where I'm most safe. And that is where the labels can't be arresting and mm-hmm. hurt me, mm-hmm. right? And so when you're talking about the dental floss, right? And we have to get in those, you know, we can't just put the floss in. We have to like get into the crevices. And that's where my mind kind of went, because it's those crevices that it looks like it's not important, but it is important because there's so such a nuanced space.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's beautiful. It makes me think of Sylvia Winter's idea of the plot and the plantation, and how she writes about enslaved communities having the plot where they grow their own food, right? And it's like so much of the focus in the historical records is about all of the labor that happened on the plantation for, you know, the enslavers, but where life was happening was on the plot. And as you're saying, it's that liminal space. And, you know, also making me think of all of the different, you know, quote unquote clandestine economies or criminalized economies, like sex work, like people that are actually experts in how every economy works, because, you know, those are the people that are making life amidst what is essentially an impossibility.
You know, Foucault actually did a lot of work on like the construction of the prison. A part of the design is to, it's punishment, right? Mm-hmm. It is punishment, but it's not just punishment of being isolated from your family. It's also punishment of not experiencing life, right? And mm-hmm. and just the way in which the building is structured, how it's designed, it's a dehumanizing experience, and it's meant to dehumanize, right? Mm-hmm. So it's difficult for rehabilitation to occur when you are being dehumanized. The barriers that you experience that you can't name and you can't verbalize, those experiences, those harsh negative experiences that while many of our clients are incarcerated, they can't explain it, they know it, they feel it. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that is really difficult. Like I hear, you know, even colleague of mine or clients of mine who have had that experience, they talk about like leaving the institution and like months, years after, having something that's called the shakes. Right, just shaking is like a consistent anxiety. When we're thinking about Black history, we have to have these conversations around incarceration, because in Canada, Indigenous population and Black population are disproportionately represented in particularly the provincial prisons, right? Mm. And so we have to start looking at what are the reasons why we have these numbers? What's causing that? What's the push-pull factor, right? And how are they able to like fall into these gaps of society and not get the support or having the support but not even being able to accept it because of something else, maybe something else that you can't name that is causing them, you know, to not be able to engage with that, right? Yeah. And so I think it's really useful that we have this conversation in a holistic way, the way that we're doing right now, because true healing is not linear, and we need to have like a general conversation or plan around what that looks like. And mm-hmm. even if we're having real restorative justice, that will also need to be incorporated, because it will have to be culturally relevant, right?
Yeah.
I'm fearful of, you know, we have these wonderful ideas that gets limited by structures. When I think about restorative justice, I think about the two top groups in Canada that could benefit from that. And I'm just really mindful that we've had a lot of positive, well-meaning movements and projects that came up and were co-opted and just lost the intention and the impact that it could have had.
If this was not just a one-month thing, but if it was a kickoff to something else, like what would the something else be?
It could be the beginning of those who, like an unvoiced being voiced. I think that Elizabeth Fry Toronto is an organization that supports women who are mostly at risk of becoming in conflict with the law, or who have been in conflict with the law, right? Most of my clients have not been like Black or Indigenous, right? Okay. And that's no fault of the organization. In one sense, I've done a lot of intake with Indigenous women and Black women, but they never follow, most of them don't follow through. And this is what I think as a Black woman. I think that we have reasons not to trust structures that are not focused or created for us.
Absolutely.
And so even if me, a Black woman, did the intake, I'm working for an organization, right? So our relationship with structures and organizations, particularly with the demographic that I was doing, was working with, has not been favorable.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if EFRI did nothing to these women, it's the archetype of EFRI.
Absolutely.
If this event could signal a kickoff of something, I think it would be wise for the kickoff, for it to be actively engaging with the population that is most impacted by incarceration. And we all know those are Indigenous and Black. So perhaps a program like Voice of the Unvoiced, or however you want to phrase it, however, whatever it want to be, it could think, if it's going to piggyback or pull off the momentum of something like this, it would be to going out in the community and actively engaging with either community agencies or individual in these communities, and having their voice be voiced.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That is a perfect kind of tie-in. I feel like that's a great note to end on also. I know we've been talking for a while. You're such a great speaker, Leslie, and I really appreciate the insight, wisdom, and also just authenticity that you bring to this conversation.